Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Our really fantastic Monday continues here. We're going to talk about the church in the news today. What are the bishops gotten up to lately? About what's the Pope up to? How's the church faring around the world in places like China or here in the United States? All kinds of stuff. If you have questions about the Catholic Church in the news, you're welcome to call this hour, 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH, if you prefer that form of it. Our guest this hour is Dr. Matthew Bunsen from EWTNnews.com. For the past 20 years, Dr. Bunsen's been active in Catholic social communications, education, writing, editing, and teaching on a variety of topics related to church history, the papacy, the saints. He probably knows as much about the papacy as anybody you've ever met, certainly as anybody I've ever met. He's faculty chair at Catholic Distance University, a senior fellow at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, and the author or co-author of more than 50 books. I can't say it any other way.
Well, you know, my motto is to go for quantity over quality.
Oh, well, I do not believe because I remember the book on Blessed Kateri Tekakwitha, and I always like to talk about your fine book on Blessed Kateri Tekakwitha because I like to show off that I can say Kateri Tekakwitha.
Well, actually, that's harder than people think. I've heard multiple pronunciations of it, so
I have practiced.
You're in good company. So, well, to be with you.
See, here in San Diego, we have a chapel to her, and on one of the Indian lands here, and so I just practiced until I could do it. Now I'm super proud of it. By the way, Dr. Bunsen's latest book is on Saint Pope Paul VI, and well timed because it's a wonderful time. Well, maybe we'll talk about some of that. The anniversary of Humanae Vitae. Again, 888-318-7884 is the number, and if you have questions about the church and the news, Dr. Bunsen is the guy to ask. I got to say, how shall I say this? Whenever we talk about bishops, there seems to be some trouble involved. What is going on in West Virginia? Can you resolve this for me?
I can. It's terrible news, and then what we hope will be better news.
Okay.
So we can start with the terrible news, which really began last September when the then bishop of the diocese, Bishop Michael Bransfield of Wheeling, Charleston, West Virginia, submitted his letter of resignation, which is required when you turn 75, to the Holy Father. It was almost immediately accepted. And with the acceptance of that, Archbishop Laurie of Baltimore was appointed apostolic administrator of the diocese and then charged with the task of investigating Bishop Bransfield on multiple allegations of sexual and financial misconduct. That investigation was effectively handed over to a group of lay investigators who turned up what was deemed, certainly as far as the Vatican is concerned and Archbishop Laurie's committee, credible allegations that we can get into more detail about what those allegations were. But it effectively led to a decree just a couple of weeks ago from the Holy See that had three things to it that are very pertinent, I think, to this conversation. The first is that Bishop Bransfield should have no more public ministry. He was not allowed to live in the diocese of Wheeling-Charleston, and he is to make amends. And the amends are going to be left to his successor, who virtually the next day, the decree came out on a Friday, I think just a couple of days later, the new bishop of Wheeling, Bishop Mark Brennan, an auxiliary bishop of Baltimore, was appointed. And boy, does he have a major task ahead of him.
So when you say make amends, does that mean remuneration, or what are we talking about here?
That's the funny thing about it. The assumption is that amends is going to be whatever Bishop Brennan deems is necessary.
Okay.
Now, some of the thinking was it could mean financial restitution, and there's very good reason to perhaps request financial restitution. But it could also be a very public display or a public statement on the part of Bishop Bransfield for his remorse, his regret, at what many see were his failings as a bishop, as well as facing these what were deemed credible allegations of sexual and financial misconduct. The financial side is pretty whopping. You had several million dollars in travel, much of it personal. You had $185,000 in fresh cut flowers, as well as about $1,000 a month in alcohol. And then the even more controversial $350,000 that was spent as gifts to different church leaders around the United States and around the world. That's been the source. You can imagine there's some controversy.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, that's just humiliating, frankly. I mean, it's humiliating to hear the bill of particulars there because what a counter witness, and it makes Catholics look like dupes, and it's horrible. It's just horrible.
Some of the problem has solved itself because, at least in terms of the gifts, because so many of the bishops who received them either were unaware that it was being paid with diocesan funds, I think were being reimbursed then to the bishop that is. But they've been returning them, I think, $7,500 from Archbishop Laurie, as well as, I think, $20,000+ from Cardinal Farrell in Rome. Notably, the former Apostolic Nuncio of the United States, Carlo Maria Vigano, returned $6,000, but he didn't actually, in a sense, if he didn't return it, but he simply donated the money when it was given to him to charity, and there's a full record of it. So in a way, he dealt with it responsibly. But you're right, it was a source of immense frustration, not just to Catholics in Wheeling.
No.
77,000 right. of them, but Catholics all across the United States. And then there's the whole tapestry of allegations of sexual misconduct.
Yeah, well, we've heard this. Sorry, but we've heard this tune so many times. I feel like there's a level of frustration. I mean, I'll put it to you this way. I mean, I feel like I'm interrogating you, like you're at fault for this. But right. No, I know that you're
feel
not.
Free.
But like it feels like a year ago, we're all outraged. A year ago, at this very moment, I think we're all outraged at the revelations about then Cardinal, now Mr. McCarrick, and. It feels, I don't know, it just feels so piecemeal to many people. I don't know if that's correct, but there doesn't seem to be a unified, systematic digging into what has happened with these bishops and
right.
what do we got to do?
Well, in the case of Bransfield, we have to be as detailed as possible. I say that not to get into gory detail.
Oh, okay.
But what I mean is that he was investigated for sexual misconduct involving adults.
Oh, okay.
He created, allegedly, an atmosphere of abuse, of intimidation, of retribution, and that was one of the ways that he was able to circumvent what many would imagine are very commonsensical limitations on what a bishop can do financially. Now, their bishops and dioceses can do all sorts of things, but he was able to circumvent a lot of that. Now, that matters because the nature of the allegations then is slightly different from what we were looking at with former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, who had a whole variety of allegations, including the abuse of minors. But to your point, you're absolutely right. There has been this perception really since June of last year that the bishops now are under even more intense scrutiny, and the church is under more intense scrutiny than we were even in 2002, 2003.
Right.
Because certain promises were made to Catholics and to the public at large that this is a problem that was being dealt with. The bishop said, basically, trust us, we have a plan. That plan was the Dallas Charter, it was the Essential Norms. And to their credit, the Dallas Charter and the Essential Norms have proven remarkably effective in dealing with the sex abuse crisis. When you look at the single digits for cases, when you look at the one case, obviously, is still too many. But we have made demonstrable, clear progress in combating clergy sexual abuse within the church. However, the new scrutiny on bishops has raised a lot of hard questions for them relating specifically to can they hold themselves accountable? So we have spent really a year on that very topic. And I think we can say that Pope Francis and February, when he gathered that summit in Rome to the bishops just in June, have really earnestly tried to deal with this problem by putting in a process. We can talk a little bit more about that.
Okay. All right. 888-318-7884. It's not all bad news. There is good news out there as well. So we're covering the church in the news
right.
with Dr. Matthew Bunsen. But I don't know. I guess the where I get to is that the laity are not crazy to be upset, and sometimes they are treated by some sections of the church like they're somehow the discontented or malcontents, you know, but they're not crazy to be upset about all this.
No, they have every reason to be upset, as they were in 2002, as they were in the years even before 2002.
Yeah.
They have also very reasonable expectations that their shepherds should be held accountable should be able to hold each other accountable, but even more importantly, from the church's standpoint, theologically and spiritually, the Holy Father is the one who has to hold them accountable. And so what we have seen then in this last year, in particular from February going forward, is we saw with the motu proprio from Pope Francis called Vos Estis Lux Mundi, you are the light of the world. It is a decree, a motu proprio, a Vatican decree, a papal decree that really goes some distance in holding bishops accountable.
Yeah, okay.
Only the Holy Father can do that.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the wrangling that happened in last November, if we all remember famously, that the bishops were forbidden, asked not to vote on anything to hold themselves accountable, in part because the Vatican was still working on this. Come their June meeting, their spring meeting, the bishops have voted in a series of measures to try to do that, to hold themselves accountable. Third-party reporting systems, what's called the Metropolitan Model, and we can explain that if you want.
Oh, yeah.
But the essence of it is that that the bishops now have at least a process in place to answer allegations, credible allegations that might be made against them that will go all the way up to the Holy Father. It has to end with him, and he's the one who has to make the verdict. That's simply the way the church functions.
I feel kind of hopeful about the Metropolitan Model. I know a lot of people there. I guess it's controversial to some degree, but could you just say what it is and why at least some people, and I'll include myself in it, that think that it will actually be helpful?
I'm something of an optimist myself about it because, okay, in a way, we've already seen it work a couple of times, and I'll come back to that. When we're talking about the Metropolitan Model, what we're really describing is a model for dealing with accusations against bishops and archbishops and cardinals that is still nested sort of within the structure of the church. So when an allegation is made, say through a third-party reporting system, which is what we're trying to put in place for every diocese and archdiocese across the country, that goes to the metropolitan archbishop of a province. In other words, the senior most bishop, usually an archbishop.
Right. Like here it would be the Archbishop of Los Angeles. Over our local cities like Orange County and San Diego and all that.
Right, Archbishop Gomez.
Right.
Now, in the case that the Metropolitan is himself the one who's being accused or under suspicion, the investigation falls to the most senior of the suffragan bishops, the suffragan bishops being the bishops that are surrounding the Metropolitan.
Right.
So if, and then from there, it just progressively moves to whoever is responsible for this. So the Metropolitan then has the obligation to oversee the investigation. We have a lot of third-party investigations that we need to be able to determine whether an allegation is credible. It is reported to the nuncio so that there is no way that this can be hidden, at least theoretically. And then he has a time limit in which he has to respond to whether the determination has been made, whether the allegations are credible or not. Now, that it may seem to some that it's sort of an arbitrary thing that there's a clock that starts ticking, but it's really to try to determine whether this is credible or not, which we can usually find is historically cases can be determined whether they're credible or not pretty quickly. Then the process then moves into the Holy See having to take over. And so, as you say, it's an interesting way of dealing with this, in part because it still respects the fact that the bishops themselves have to hold each other accountable, but it still gives us that direct route to the Holy See and to the Holy Father.
Dr. Matthew Bunsen is our guest. We got to take a quick break. The topic is the church in the news. So if you got a question about the church in the news, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. If you're on the line, stay on the line. We're going to get to your calls right after this.
This is Dr. Scott Hahn, and stay tuned for more Catholic Answers Live.
A lot of people think that street evangelization involves yelling out of a bullhorn telling people that they're going to hell. Not so with St. Paul's Street Evangelization. Our methods are non-confrontational and effective. We simply offer information on the Catholic faith along with rosaries, miraculous medals, and prayer. Pope Francis wrote about how beautiful it is to see street preachers joyfully bringing Jesus to every corner of the earth. Street evangelization is fun and fruitful. Join us today at streetevangelization.com.
He is honored by the Church as a saint with the title of the Angelic Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Thomas Aquinas wrote a basic textbook for young theology students that became the Church's most famous guide to the faith, the Summa Theologica. It helped him earn the title Doctor of the Church. He died in 1274.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
So many ways the church is in the news, and you might want to talk about the news of the church, the China situation, Pope Francis in China, conversations being had about women preaching at Mass. Pope Emeritus Benedict hitting the road, visiting some Italian towns and ending up at at a vacation spot. We'll talk about that. As we talked about Humanae Vitae, the anniversary, the 51st anniversary. We can talk about that stuff going on at Planned Parenthood, always things. There always seems to be something to be said about Archbishop Sheen and his sainthood process. So if you got questions about that, all I'm trying to say is that, look, there's a lot of stuff going on. If you got questions about what's going on in the Catholic Church, today is your day to call. 888-318-7884. Our guest today is Dr. Matthew Bunsen. And Dr. Bunsen, lots of calls, shall we?
Sure.
All right. Let's start with Brad in Denver, Colorado, listening on 1060, the mighty 1060 AM there in Denver, Colorado. Brad, your question for Dr. Bunsen.
Yes, thank you for this important topic. I've got a friend who teaches in the Diocese of West Virginia there, Wheeling, Charleston. And my question is, how is it that the Financial Oversight Committee of the Archdiocese didn't notice malfeasance of 6- and 7-digit numbers? This is not an enormous diocese with, $100 billion budget or something. This is a relatively small diocese, and I just fail to understand how the financial committee didn't catch this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, part of it is that there's sometimes a misconception about Wheeling in that it is absolutely a very rural and small diocese. There are about 77,000 Catholics, and yet it has what by someone actually described to me as a mountain of money. Now, it depends on your definition of a mountain, but you're talking about several hundred million dollars, I believe, from oil and a few other things that were given to the church. So that, as you can imagine, is an immense temptation to anyone who has oversight of it. And if you combine that with, as I was mentioning, this atmosphere that is alleged to have been created by Bishop Bransfield, of intimidation, of fear, of retribution, you begin to appreciate how it was possible for some of those basic controls to be circumvented, and that people tend to trust their ordinary, and that he somehow has their goodwill at heart. So I think it was a combination of things that took place there. And the other thing, too, is that I'm not a forensic accountant, so I won't try to get into the nitty-gritty legal details of this. But the spending and things that took place, I do not believe, and anyone can call in, feel free to correct me, were necessarily illegal because the way things are structured, he had access to those funds. He simply needed to inform the Diocesan Finance Council and others that this was happening. Again, it's easy to look back and wonder how things happen, but it's much easier to do that after things have been revealed. So I can well imagine the frustration that was very present among many people in the diocese at what had happened. And one of the interesting things about the appointment of Bishop Brennan as the new bishop is his reputation for a very simple and humble lifestyle, as well as what has been described as his pastoral sensitivity. So I think he's arriving with a very clear mandate. I've been using the aphorism that you have one job, and that is to bring real healing, but better financial oversight to the diocese. He's 72, so I don't think we can expect that he's going to be present for that long as a bishop, which gives, I think, help to him that he can really focus on what needs to happen here.
Brad, thank you very much. I hope that was helpful to you. We do have plenty of church law on how money is supposed to be responsibly handled at the diocesan level. There's supposed to be a finance council that has real power. But again, this is one of those things where, to be honest with you, I'm not trying to be cranky about the bishops, but many bishops have ignored the law.
Well, that's been one of the ongoing challenges over the years. And it's important to have those sort of internal structures present. And it's, I think, one of those also features of the post-Second Vatican Council era, in which some were concerned about over-bureaucratization or excessive activities on the part of lay people, that type of thing. But one of the things that we have seen in the recent years, recent decades, is recourse to a bishop really working with finance councils and others to be good stewards of the money and the temporal goods that have been given to us as a church. And any bishop, I think, who is good and holy recognizes the importance of that participation on the part of lay people for the good of the whole diocese.
Again, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, our guest. We have several callers on this topic, and I want to go to your callers. Don't worry, I'm going to get to you, but I don't want to do one story for the entire hour since we're doing the Church in the News. So I will ask you this, because people call us and ask us, and we almost always give the same answer, I don't know, to this question. And that is,
right.
What's happening with Pope Francis and China and the bishops there? And I feel utterly at a loss when people ask me about it.
It's one of those questions that you're not alone in responding in the way you do.
Oh, okay. All right.
So don't feel bad.
I probably will anyway, but all right.
part of it is very basic that a lot of this seemed to happen in September. We had the whole West Virginia thing last September. Also last September, we had the Holy See announcing its deal of some type with the government of China, with the People's Republic of China. And it had largely to do with the appointment of bishops. And it had really the intent of trying to normalize or regularize the way that bishops are appointed in China. But it also had the more internal intent of trying to bring healing to what had been a pretty divided church in China between members who were part of the patriotic church that is run and controlled by the Chinese government and the so-called underground church. The problem has been, in a way, that we still are not privy to any of the details. We have vague idea of what was arranged, but the specific details are not really forthcoming. Part of that is because it's an arrangement between two governments, and oftentimes the details are not revealed. But also, this, as has been pointed out since then, is a provisional agreement. It is something that could hypothetically be revisited. So call it a work in progress. Now, one of the things that we do know is that at the end of June, what was called the Pastoral Guidelines of the Holy See Concerning the Civil Registration of Clergy in China was issued. I know that's a mouthful. Basically, recognizing the need to normalize relations between the communist government and the Catholic community. What basically it does is to give priests the option to act on their conscience regarding whether or not they have to register. So it raises a host of other questions that how they are going to function under that system and whether this is also, once again, sort of creating a de facto underground church. So that perplexity is not something that is lost on any of us. I wish that more details were actually available, but as I said, this is just a work in progress.
All right. Okay. Well, fair enough. That actually, I mean, the part that isn't being reported is, at least that I was missing, is that much of this is not being reported. So that helps me understand, why do I feel so out of the loop on this? I am out of the loop on this.
Well, and part of the issue is that we have to look at the wider context. And I think this is where the situation is very alarming. It's why someone like Cardinal Zen, the Bishop Emeritus of Hong Kong, has been outspoken for so long. And those who observe China are also concerned, because this is part of a wider process of what's known as sinicization taking place in China under the government of Xi Jinping, who is the premier. And it's an effort to bring all of the religions of China, not just the Catholic faith, but every religion in China, under much more direct control of the Chinese government.
Right.
And that has brought with it pretty severe persecution in individual provinces. It varies considerably from province to province.
Right, right.
But we're also seeing the persecution of the Uyghur Muslims in Western China. And that's at times severely underreported.
Yes.
There are reports of concentration camps, of re-education camps. So this is cutting across the board. But it is obviously a grave concern to Catholics that Catholic priests should be in this situation, but also that you have new laws coming out of the Chinese government that would actually prohibit anyone under the age of 18 from entering churches and really from participating in the life of the faith.
Yeah.
So how you deal with that is going to be another question.
The church has been dealing with evil communist regimes for a long time. China, this is something I think we don't make this distinction enough either. China, a great and wonderful civilization and country run by bad people, really bad people, who have a history of oppressing others. We'll be right back to continue our conversation on the Church and the News with Dr. Matthew Bunsen right after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
In his new audio presentation, The Very First Fathers, apologist Jimmy Akin takes you on a tour of the earliest Christian writings outside the New Testament, from the most famous figures and most notable works to those lesser known but no less important. This pivotal time in the development of the early church is revealed in fascinating detail. Jimmy shows how, even in the first century after the resurrection, it was necessary to defend and explain truths that are still under attack today, such as the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and the perpetual virginity of Mary. The Very First Fathers is a compelling look at the dawn of the Christian age and edifying listening for anyone who wants to understand and defend the full truth of Catholicism. Order your copy of The Very First Fathers today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew she wanted those things, that in them, somehow, she would find God. Over the years, as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
I'm Gloria Purvis.
And I'm Deacon Harold.
The Morning Glory team asks, are Catholic schools Catholic enough?
Next on most of these EWTN stations.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I told you it was going to be a good one. Dr. Matthew Bunsen is our guest. You can find him at EWTNnews.com, among many other places. And you can find his latest book, St. Pope Paul VI, right?
That's right.
Okay, I got it. Is that an Ignatius book too?
You got it. So, EWTN books.
What was I thinking?
Although Ignatius has many wonderful books.
They do. That's right.
They do.
But they don't need extra plugs from us. They get plenty. All right.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Mark Brumley over there. Do you know Mark Brumley?
I do.
The president? Yeah.
Yes.
We have our suspicions about him, but I will move on. We have a question from David in Alabama, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. David, your question for Dr. Matthew Bunsen.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. Just wanted to follow up on the metropolitan model that you all were talking about. I guess, as I understand it, there are some benefits, but what's perplexing to me is what's happened with the investigation of the bishop in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, when the Metropolitan investigated the bishop, he was working with a lay board, and the lay board put together an investigative report which went over some of the abuses and the problems with Bishop Bransfield. And in the course of the investigation, the report actually disclosed that there was approximately $350,000 of cash payments made by Bishop Bransfield to various clergy, including some clergy that were very high up in the church, cardinals and other archbishops. And this was tens of thousands of dollars were going to these people. I guess the appearance was that it might have been hush money to people who could have controlled or brought some kind of accusations against the bishop. That's what it appeared to me to be.
Does that give you a sense that the metropolitan model won't work? Because that's what the sense I'm getting, David. But is that where you're going with this?
The church. Well, yeah, I guess the question is when the lay board identified the folks. Apparently, Archbishop Laurie redacted the names of any of the clergy that received these gifts. And it was only, and apparently the people on the lay board were very upset about it, so they released the unredacted report to the Washington Post, and then they ran it. And at that time, Bishop Laurie recanted and said, well, he made a mistake. And I was wondering, given that those circumstances, whether the metropolitan model really can work. I
mean, okay, that's fair enough.
Yeah, actually, this is a really great question because it circles back in a way to something that I was talking about a little while ago, and that was that the In some ways, the metropolitan model has always been in effect, and in other ways has been pretty effective. I say that because with the way that the McCarrick scandal unfolded was that the very credible allegations found their way to the Archdiocese of New York, and Cardinal Timothy Dolan went through the process of determining whether they're credible or not. They were deemed to be credible, and with the permission of the Holy See, everything moved forward. The result, of course, is the inevitable forced laicization or reduction to the lay state of former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. In the case of Bishop Bransfield, in some ways, too, you can say that the metropolitan model worked. Now, do we have kinks that we need to work out? Are there problems that still need to be ironed out? Absolutely. And I think the caller very nicely pointed to one of them, and that is that in the case of Archbishop Laurie, there was a redaction of some of the information. He had his reasons for doing so and subsequently apologized publicly. But what it demonstrated is that there is no appetite for this type of activity on the part of lay people who spoke out very publicly. And to his credit, Archbishop Laurie responded very publicly. And it was Archbishop Laurie who had the responsibility of overseeing the investigation in a way along the lines that the metropolitan model was supposed to follow and subsequently did, in that he relied on experts from outside of the church hierarchy, obviously, lay people with expertise that could be relied upon by the archbishop and church authorities to determine whether or not these allegations were credible, and then to work out the details of that. So the investigation, I think, proved, at least in the early going, that the metropolitan model is functional and can work when it's effective. But it's also a demonstration that going forward, as these types of investigations take place, we're going to need lay people to be very actively involved. And for a lot of people, there's a natural temptation just to throw your arms up and say, I'm done with this. Well, my answer to that is, first, where are you going to go? There's nowhere outside of the church you can or should go. But the other is to work for reform, authentic reform, in the way that the church has always had authentic reform.
Thanks, David, very much for the question and for the call. 888-318-7884 is our number here. Our topic is the church in the news. So if you've got any question at all about the church in the news, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. It seems to me, Dr. Bunsen, that Catholic media is in a bit of an unsettled state, with some news sites becoming quite combative towards the Pope, others defending the Pope, others maybe taking a more traditionally journalistic role. It seems like a mess. And I sometimes I don't know what to believe. And in that context, having said all of that, can you tell me what's happening at the John Paul II Institute because what I'm getting in some news reports is that this borders on the criminal, what's going on there. So could you help me out?
Right. Yeah. Well, I would encourage everyone to read Edward Penton's great work in this area, especially the National Catholic Register, because he's been on this story for quite some time. What we're talking about is the famous John Paul II Institute for Studies in the Marriage and Family that he founded. And subsequently, we have institutes all over the world, including where I am right now in Washington, D.C. And these are deeply respected institutions. What we've seen in the last couple of years is an effort to revise the statutes of the John Paul II Institute, especially the one in Rome, to reflect, in many ways, the outlook, the perspective of Pope Francis, especially in light of the apostolic exhortation Amoris Laetitia, and his sort of holistic view of family life. It's much more oriented toward the pastoral solutions and study of the pastoral situations in light of the modern challenges of today's world. There is controversy because there are those who argue that in much the same way that we have seen with things like the Pontifical Academy for Life, that there is what some are worried is an abandonment of the way that the Institute was run previously.
Okay.
And also the focus on the part of John Paul II in things like the theology of the body. So the fear is that there's a watering down of the philosophy and theology, the beautiful corpus of teachings on the part of John Paul II in light of a new structure for doing that. And we have seen recent resignations and the decision not to reappoint various officials at the John Paul II Institute, including its rector. What is being seen by many is a sort of sea change in the leadership,
okay.
As well as a lot of people, professors being left in suspense as to whether or not they are going to be reconfirmed in their roles and what sort of changes are coming to the curriculum. So I can appreciate the concern. I think the best answer to that is let's wait and see what the final product looks like.
Yeah.
But certainly I can understand why some might be alarmed by this.
And I wasn't aware of this part, that there are kind of, this is an institute that's in various cities around the world.
Yes, it is. So you okay. have, I think there's a famous one in Sydney. There's one in D.C. It's an open question as to how they're being impacted as well by these changes, but I think we can be safe to say that whatever's coming is likely to. So there was also a decree on the part of Pope Francis just a couple of months ago looking at the way that a lot of ecclesiastical faculties function, trying to bring them again into what some would see as a more modern approach. Some would see that they argue it's a modernist approach.
Oh, okay.
So very strong opinions about this. In many ways, as we have very strong opinions about almost everything that happens in this pontificate.
Really? You feel,
Believe it or not.
You feel like people have strong feelings about Pope Francis?
It's just an observation on my part. It may not be accurate.
Fair enough. I think he probably is. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Church in the News is the topic. The number, again, 888-318-7884. Your calls, welcome. We're going to keep working our way through news stories. And your participation is always welcome. I want to note again what I said earlier, that there's only 3 days left in that half-off sale on all the electronically transmitted materials of Catholic Answers, whether it's e-magazines, e-books, MP3 downloads, that kind of stuff. If you go over to shop.catholic.com, it's all 50% off right now, but that sale ends July 31st at midnight. So head over to shop.catholic.com and get 50% off everything with an E in front of it right now.
Your number one source for Catholic apologetics and evangelization, Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
the leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
I want to talk to you about the importance of bringing the news to you every day. And we do that two ways on Catholic Connection. Firstly, we give you a newscast that I write and give to you to keep you up to date on what's happening in the world in the church. And then we also do interviews daily to help you understand everything from a truly Catholic perspective.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, tomorrow morning, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Church in the News. Lines are filling up, so you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. We'll try to get to calls as quickly as we can. Just a slight bit of good news as these calls are being screened. I guess it's good. It feels like good news to me to see Pope Emeritus Benedict out and about. And the reporting I saw this morning, even the reporters seem to be taking delight in reporting on him being out and about.
I think that would be very safe to say. Yeah, any news that we get of Pope Benedict, the Pope Emeritus Benedict, is welcome as long as it's good news. And this, I think, we can safely say. We were talking at the start of the show about there's not necessarily a lot of good news. Well, this is good news. Basically, he took a field trip.
Yeah.
And here's a man in his 90s who, and there had been stories for a while now about his potentially poor health. Well, he's good enough to make a surprise visit to Castel Gandolfo. Now, boy, that's a name that we don't hear a lot of these days.
No.
Because Pope Francis is an ardent believer in the staycation. He doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
He stays in the Vatican. He stays at the Casa Santa Marta. So Castel Gandolfo has been slightly forgotten in this pontificate. So I'm sure they were very happy to have Pope Emeritus Benedict suddenly arriving at their door.
It's not a pope, but it's the closest
the closest thing we've got.
Yeah.
So he visited the gardens again I know he was very fond of. I believe he also went to there's a sanctuary nearby, and then went to the nearby town of Frascati, where he had dinner with one of the local bishops. And then went back to the Vatican, which is, it's a nice statement that he's up and around and engaged. And let's keep praying. I derive immense comfort as a Catholic and also as a citizen of the world that we have this Pope Emeritus in his small home in the Vatican Gardens praying for us every day.
Yeah.
He's a spiritual dynamo, and while we are still trying to figure out exactly what a Pope Emeritus is and does, I'll take his prayers.
Yeah, and he could take a trip every now and then. It's funny when you think about, I don't funny it, but I think it's actually a positive sign about the state of at least charity within the church. You remember in the 80s when the Ratzinger report came out, this was not a beloved figure. This was not a man who'd say, across the Catholic world, the beloved Joseph Ratzinger.
Well, what were the nicknames? He had Panzer Cardinal, God's Rottweiler.
Yeah.
Yes. And yet, all of those were such terrible misconceptions and misstatements and misrepresentations of who he really was. As we saw when he was Pope, this is a profoundly gentle soul. But his mind is going to go down, I think, as one of the greatest in the history of the church. I've said for a long time that John Paul II I'd love to see as a doctor of the church. But I think we can honor Joseph Ratzinger, not necessarily as a doctor of the church. That's going to be up to a future pope, but certainly as one of the great intellects, one of the great theologians in the history of the church, and one of, if not the greatest, theologian pope
we've
ever had. Yeah.
What a gift God's given us in the last, I don't know, even if you go back 150 years, you say it's just one fine pope after another, really saintly men who were great intellects, and you cap it off with some of these recent popes, and you really do feel God's blessed us in recent years.
Absolutely. We were talking about the John Paul II Institute. John Paul II has been gone now since 2005.
Yeah.
And history is always, so they always say that the history is the harshest of critics. And yet I think what we're seeing in history is so much of what John Paul II predicted, in much the same way that Pope Paul VI was a prophet in his own time, we are seeing coming to pass. One of the things that strikes me about John Paul II is that he tried to warn us about the threats to the dignity of the human person in the face of modernity. Now, in the 21st century, right. we are seeing threats to the very definition of what a person is, how yeah. we define personhood. And we can look back now on the theology of the body, but also John Paul II. I always go back to his first encyclical, Redemptor Hominis, which basically said that man is a mystery until he sees himself in Christ. And that is a lesson for us today. And as we move farther and farther away from a real understanding of the dignity of the human person, John Paul II, I think, is emerging once again as a key figure in understanding that.
And our current Pope, Pope Francis, has been very strong on things like the transgenderism and those kinds of things. And you see this, I mean, everyone wants to point out how different Francis is, but on many things like this, he's not different. He's standing up for the dignity of the human person.
That's absolutely right. And he is a beneficiary of Paul VI, of John Paul II, and of Pope Benedict XVI. In understanding, coming as he does from Argentina, from the New World, the global implications of the threats to human dignity. And so when we hear him talk about the transgender ideology that we're seeing, yeah. but not just the ideology itself, but the way it's being used in what he refers to as sort of neocolonialism.
Wonderful.
The imposition
yeah.
Of these ideological ideas, including the transgender movement,
right.
On countries that are still developing, that are vulnerable.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of those things that we would do well to heed his words when we're looking at places like Africa and the Amazon.
You do get the feeling that with Francis, he's one of those people that many of the things he does, it'll be after he's gone that people will go, look what he did in this area. And that neocolonialism thing, this ideological colonialism that he talks about is brilliant. I mean, I feel like in time it will mean as much as Pope John Paul II's Culture of Life came to mean. That will it encapsulates something so beautifully that it's very, very helpful.
Yes. And the idea of integral ecology, which is, yeah. I know, somewhat controversial in some circles, especially in light of Laudato Si, and then also yeah. what we're seeing with the potential in the Synod. But there is this idea of you cannot separate the person from the environment in the sense of created order,
right.
And the concepts of the teachings of stewardship and other things.
Right.
So these, I think, are going to be valuable.
Just before we move on from Pope Benedict, Pope Emeritus Benedict, then, he's done a great service to the church in his support for Pope Francis, in his not being a critic, not being a nitpicker, in being mostly silent, and then when he speaks, being helpful.
Yes. Not only is he supportive of Pope Francis, we've seen that really from the start, reiterating that there is only one pope. Also reiterating as well how well he and Francis get along. What's been also fun to watch and very educational, very illuminating, is those areas where Pope Benedict Emeritus actually chooses to speak. So, for example, just recently, this last spring, he wrote a letter that sort of waded into the sex abuse crisis. And part of it was right at the time that we had this summit in February, the grappling with the whole issues of the sex abuse crisis, Pope Emeritus Benedict issues this letter in which he was able to frame his own vision, his own context for how he handled it. And you mentioned that I've written a lot of books. One of those books was Pope Benedict XVI and the Clergy Sexual Abuse Crisis that I co-authored with Greg Erlandson, and that all the way back in 2010. And that was an effort to try to defend the authentic record of Pope Benedict in the face of the clergy sexual abuse crisis. So to have this new contribution, I think, was really valuable. And to have those insights as well from a theologian, but also somebody who was Pope. And one of the things that struck me immediately after the election of Pope Francis is that there's really only one person on the face of the earth who can understand what Pope Francis is carrying, and that's Pope Benedict. And I really do think that Pope Francis has availed himself of the opportunity to rely on that.
Now you've given me the opportunity for a shameless plug, because we thought so much of Pope Benedict's letter that you just mentioned that I read it into a microphone. They recorded it and we're giving it away free so people that don't have time to read it can listen to it. Though, hey, if you want it, and you should get it, it's really good. We love giving you free stuff. You got to join Radio Club, and it's very easy to join Radio Club. Just go to CatholicAnswersLive.com and put in your email address, or just text. text CA Live to this number, 44222. CA Live to 44222. And
let me do a shameless plug back at you, because I would encourage everyone to listen to that, because it is something to be able to spend a little more time in the mind of Joseph Ratzinger.
Yeah, and he answers, he gives his answer to the question, what do we do now? And that's everyone's asking that question. And now you have, like you said, the greatest theologian pope of all time is answering it. You should listen to him.
But also how we got here.
Yeah,
And that brings us in a way to the 51st anniversary of Humanae Vitae that we've just marked.
And another book that everyone on earth should read, Saint Pope Paul VI.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
What happened to Chris? Did we just lose Chris from Atlanta? Oh, we did. Oh, I was just going to go to a call for you. All right. I got another call for you though. Let's go to John in Utah. Sorry, Chris, by the way, if you're still listening. Sorry, but we got excited about talking about the popes. John's also listening on Sirius XM Satellite Channel 130, which is EWTN on Sirius Satellite Radio. John, your question or comment for Dr. Matthew Bunsen.
Yeah, hi. I'm curious. I'd heard recently that 1 Corinthians 11:27 about receiving the body and blood of Jesus Christ and in an unworthy manner was removed from the lectionary, and I'm wondering if you know if that's true. I heard that it was, so I just any input you can have would be great.
Checking the rumor mill. Did that get taken out of the lectionary?
No, not that I've actually heard, in part because the generally changes to lectionaries require quite a bit of work, in much the same way that we've talked recently about some of the changes to the Italian lectionary about the Our Father and other things. To the best of my knowledge, and feel free to correct me, anyone who's listening, I have not actually heard about that change.
So there you are. All right.
And poor Chris.
I think the... Thanks. Okay. Oh, yeah, poor Chris, because we made him wait. John, thank you very much. But if there had been a change to the lectionary, I can tell you Dr. Bunsen would have heard about it. So
I'd like to think so,
yeah.
But...
He has access to the entire network of Vatican satellites and spies. So, is that true?
We're not supposed to talk about that.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't joke about things like that because there are people who take that quite seriously. There are, I don't know if you know this, but there are some conspiracy theories about the Catholic Church.
Well, I mean, we've seen that just in the last couple of weeks with the Emanuela Orlandi case of a young girl who disappeared, I think, at the age of 15 back in 1983.
Yeah.
And there were recent digging excavations into some of the tombs at the Teutonic College near the Vatican. I mention all of this because it's an obscure case, but it's an indicator of just the level of intense interest in anything relating to the Vatican and anything relating to the Vatican that might involve conspiracy theories. So the findings were that the poor, unfortunate young woman who's still missing, her bones were not found there. But it was an interesting statement to me of how involved the Holy See was in that entire matter and how quickly and how forthcoming they tried to be in cooperating with Italian authorities, but also with forensic experts and the Orlandi family. So it's... sort of we've seen the evolution in a way of the Vatican press outfit over the last year or so.
Right.
And they seem to be very determined to be as transparent as possible with these types of stories.
Now they are. I mean, you feel like it should have been all along. I mean, really, it's the Church of Jesus Christ. He founded it. A little transparency would have been good all along.
Well, or efficiency too, but we are talking at times, as the old saying goes, that the wheels of Rome grind slow, but they grind exceedingly fine.
Well, we have, I can't believe that we've done an hour. I apologize again to caller Chris, who didn't get to get on, but you gave up. I was coming to you. Dr. Matthew Bunsen has been our guest. I say it every time you're on, but we really should make this a regular thing. I apologize that I have no follow through. I have all the intentions, but no follow through. I apologize.
Well, the one saving grace is there's always going to be news.
That's right. That's right. And I appreciate your knowledge of it. You can find Dr. Matthew Bunsen's work at National Catholic Register, at EWTNnews.com. Where else? Anywhere else you want to mention that we can find?
Well, I'm still with CDU, so Catholic Distance
University.
University,
right.
St. Paul Center. But catch up on all the news of my incredible colleagues at the EWTN News at EWTNnews.com.
And apparently the entire Catholic world would grind to a halt if Dr. Bunsen wasn't there. He's in all these places.
I have not heard that.
Open forum tomorrow. So if you didn't get your question in today, you can ask tomorrow, but we'll just say we don't know. So see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.